Welcome to the deep dive. So you know the names, Marx and Engels. For what, a century? They've basically been treated as this one single entity.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a brand name, Marx and Engels. The story we're always told is pretty straightforward.
Right? Marx is the genius. The
singular talent. And Engels, well, he's the loyal friend, the guy with the checkbook, the editor who, you know, tidies everything up for the masses, the second fiddle.
But our sources for today, especially the work by Terrell Carver, they completely flip that narrative on its head.
They really do. Carver's whole point is that this view is a huge distortion. He argues Engels was actually the architect of the system we call Marxism.
The architect. So not just the helper.
Not at all. He made these really distinct, totally crucial contributions that shaped what the world would come to know and, you know, fight wars over.
So our mission today in this deep dive is to pull Engels out from behind Marx's massive shadow. We want to show you why you should see him as the strategist, the one who actually built their work into this systematic scientific doctrine.
And you can't even begin to understand him without getting this central paradox of his life. I mean, it's just fascinating.
The ultimate contradiction.
Exactly. He's the son of a very wealthy, very religious German factory owner. And he spends his entire life trying to tear down the very system that made his family rich. He funded the revolution by being a capitalist.
Yeah, so let's start right there, because that double life seems to be the key to everything. He wasn't just theorizing about capitalism from a library.
No, he was an insider. I mean, think about it. From 1850 to 1870, for 20 years, he's in Manchester, England.
The heart of the industrial world at the time.
The absolute heart of it. And he's managing the family cotton firm. So by day, he looks like any other member of the British business elite.
And the sources say he played the part well. A bon vivant, fluent in a dozen languages, went fox hunting.
Oh, completely. He moved in those circles seamlessly. But then, by night, he's this other person. He's writing these secret revolutionary pamphlets and sending piles of money to keep Marx and his family alive in London.
So he's sitting there in the engine room watching the whole thing work. The competition, the workers, the profits. So how did that practical knowledge make his theory different from what Marx was doing?
It gave him a kind of empirical grounding that Marx, who was, you know, buried in books at the British Museum, just didn't have. Marx understood the abstract logic, the deep structure of political economy.
But Engels saw it on the ground.
He saw it on the factory floor. He knew the grit, the grime, the lived reality of it. He understood competition because he was doing it.
It sounds like he wasn't just the money guy either. He had this much broader skill set.
Absolutely. People forget he had this incredible grasp of military affairs and revolutionary strategy. It was so good, his friends all called him the general. The general.
That says a lot.
It tells you he was the practical mind, the strategist of the whole operation.
Okay, so if he's this independent thinker, what's the first major piece of work he does that really stands on its own, that shows off this empirical approach?
That would have to be his 1845 book, The Condition of the Working Class in England.
Yeah.
This was way before their most famous collaborations.
And we tend to read that now as, you know, a piece of political propaganda, a fiery call to action.
Right. But Carver's point is that it's so much more than that. He argues it's one of the first great works of empirical urban sociology.
Sociology? How so?
Well, he didn't just sit and write from theory. He walked the slums of Manchester. He used official government reports, statistics. He interviewed workers directly. He documented the human cost of the Industrial Revolution in just shocking granular detail.
That kind of detail must have been, well, revolutionary in itself at the time.
It was everything. It gave Marx the concrete data, the moral fire he needed for his later work. Engels was the field agent, basically sending back intelligence that proved this wasn't just some abstract philosophical problem. It was a human catastrophe.
And he didn't stop at economics. He started applying this materialist analysis to other areas Marx hadn't really touched, right?
Yes. He was driven to make it a total worldview. Look at his book, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State.
Okay.
In it, he argues that things like the nuclear family, or even gender roles, aren't natural or God-given. He said they were social structures created by specific economic systems.
Wow. That's a huge leap, applying economic logic to the most personal parts of life. He also had a lot to say about the state itself.
Exactly. The general was always focused on strategy. How do you actually win? Marx was a bit vague on what happens right after a revolution, but Engels brought this critical clarity.
What was his big idea there?
Well, he argued that you don't just abolish the state overnight. That's naive. Instead, he came up with that famous phrase, the state has to wither away.
It withers away.
It suggests a long, gradual process. It's a much more pragmatic, strategic way of thinking about the transition.
And this is where we get to the absolute core of Carver's thesis. This drive for a complete system is what leads Engels to essentially create Marxism.
That's the crux of it. After Marx died, you had these huge socialist parties growing, especially in Germany. They needed a unified doctrine. They needed a science to give them legitimacy. Engels saw that, and he stepped in.
So let's break down this key distinction. Marx mainly used something called historical materialism. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. Historical materialism was, at its heart, a method for analyzing society. A tool. It says that the way a society produces things, its economic base, determines its politics, its culture, everything. And that history moves forward through the struggle between classes.
Okay, so it's a method, a lens to look through. How did Engels change that when he developed dialectical materialism?
He took that lens and, well, he turned it into a telescope to see the entire universe. In books like Anti-During, he expands it into dialectical materialism, or DM.
And DM is different because...
Because it's not just a theory of society anymore. It becomes a universal law of everything. Of nature, of chemistry, of physics, of human thought, a total worldview.
So, to put it simply, Marx saw human history as being driven by these economic laws.
Mm-hmm.
But Engels saw the entire cosmos, from rocks to revolutions, operating under the very same set of scientific dialectical laws.
Precisely. And this is the game-changing move. He argued that these dialectical laws, like the transformation of quantity into quality, were as objective and real as the laws of gravity.
Okay, that phrase, transformation of quantity into quality, sounds incredibly academic. Can you give us a simple example of what he meant?
Of course. This is key to the deterministic feel he introduced. In nature, it's easy. Think about water. You add heat, that's quantitative change, right? It's more of the same thing.
You're just increasing the temperature.
Yeah, exactly. But at 100 degrees Celsius, something sudden happens. The water doesn't just get hotter, it turns into steam. A total qualitative change. The quantity of heat transforms the quality of the substance.
Okay, I get that. So how does that apply to politics?
Well, the idea is that society works the same way. You have a slow buildup of small injustices, wage cuts, longer hours, small strikes. These are all quantitative changes. But eventually, you reach a tipping point.
And boom.
And boom. A revolution. A sudden qualitative leap. This idea gave the movement this incredible sense of scientific certainty. They weren't just fighting for a better world. They were on the right side of the laws of history.
Which is brilliant politically. It leads directly to his pamphlet, Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. Just the title alone is a masterstroke.
A total strategic masterpiece. By calling their ideas scientific, he gave them an aura of inevitability. It made their opponents, the Utopians, look like well-meaning but naive dreamers. We're not just hoping, he was saying. We know.
Then, of course, Marx dies in 1883, and Engels becomes his literary executor, editing the last two volumes of Capital. That's an incredible amount of power to have over a friend's legacy.
Immense power. And Carver shows it was an almost impossible task. Marx's notes were a complete mess, just fragments, chaotic scribbles. Engels had to build them into a coherent book.
But I have to ask, doesn't that mean he's inserting his own ideas, smoothing things over to fit his own systematic view? Is it really Marx's work anymore?
That's the million-dollar question. And the consensus is, yes, absolutely. In his effort to create a finished, unified system, he inevitably ironed out contradictions in Marx's notes. He presented Capital as this closed, finished thing when the original material was probably much more open-ended.
He essentially retrofitted his own systematic framework onto Marx's raw ideas.
In a way, yes. He cemented his dialectical materialism into the very core of what the world would come to call Marxism.
So that's the great paradox.
Yeah.
Engels saves his friend's work from being lost to history, but in the process of popularizing it, he turns it into this rigid orthodoxy that Marx himself might not have even recognized.
It's a profound dilemma of preservation versus transformation. But we should also remember that Engels, the general, was always a pragmatist.
What do you mean?
Well, late in his life, in 1895, he wrote an introduction to one of Marx's old essays. And in it, he actually acknowledged that in some countries, a peaceful parliamentary path to socialism might be possible.
So he wasn't a dogmatist?
No. He understood that theory had to adapt to reality. The goal was fixed, but the tactics could change.
So after this deep dive, what are the lessons for you, the listener, today? Because this is about more than just 19th century history.
I think the first thing is about critical thinking. Carver's work really teaches you to question any packaged ideology.
Yeah.
You have to look past the famous founder, who were the editors. The popularizers. They're the ones who turn ideas into doctrine.
And second, it's a huge lesson in how organizations actually work. You need to understand the role of the Engels figure, that person who takes a brilliant, complex vision and turns it into a workable plan. Every successful project, whether it's in business or tech or politics, it needs that synthesizer. Ideas need a strategist to become real.
And I think, philosophically, his whole life's work can be seen in that one phrase he developed: freedom is the recognition of necessity. It's this attempt to balance the deterministic laws he saw with the idea that humans can still make choices.
So we came into this thinking of Engels as the sidekick, the guy with the money.
And we should leave seeing him as a brilliant and, yeah, very complex thinker in his own right. His contributions, the scientific framework, the system, the determinism, they were what built the foundation of 20th century political movements. You can't see them as one mind anymore. They're two distinct thinkers with two distinct legacies.
So as we close, here's a final thought to take with you, drawn from Carver's analysis. Engels created a simplified, easily digestible ism to unify a mass movement. He gave it the power of a scientific narrative. So ask yourself this: where in our world today, in politics, in tech, in our own culture, are complex ideas being simplified, maybe necessarily so, to achieve mass acceptance, but in the process are being stripped of their critical power? That is something worth mulling over.